Lawmakers announced that they are going to delay a vote in the U.S. Senate on the Respect for Marriage Act until after the November midterm elections. The bill, which has already passed the House, would write into law protections for same-sex and interracial marriages. The bill's lead sponsor, Wisconsin Democrat Tammy Baldwin, has been trying to secure enough Republican support to pass, but some opponents are worried about how the law could impact religious liberties. Here's Senator Baldwin in an interview this week on CNN.
That's one of the concerns that my Republican colleagues have been raising. A new law, does that create some new exemptions? And the answer is absolutely not. And while we think it is clear and said so in the op-ed, we are entertaining a clarifying amendment so that that argument falls flat and we can get the necessary number of Republicans to join all the Democrats and pass the Respect for Marriage Act.
But evidently not until after the midterm elections. So we're taking a closer look this afternoon at the bill and the religious liberty concerns that have come with it. And we want to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this Respect for Marriage Act or the old Defense of Marriage Act, which is now on the books? Do you want to see the new law passed in, and do you agree with the concerns about how it could affect churches' religions? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies and affiliate faculty at the Law School of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So we hear a lot about the Respect for Marriage Act codifying same-sex and interracial marriages into law, but what does that mean legally, Howard?
Right. So it's a little bit complicated. The act is broken into parts. There are three sections that matter. Section 2 of the act repeals the old Defense of Marriage Act, which was overruled, which was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in United States versus Windsor. That has to be pretty uncontroversial, unless and until the Supreme Court reverses that ruling. This is just bringing federal law in accordance with what the Supreme Court says the Constitution requires. So it's hard to see how anybody could really object to that. But the sections 3 and 4 are much more interesting. Section 3 refers to something called the Full Faith and Credit Clause. Now, the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the Constitution is a clause that says each state is required to recognize and give validity to the actions of other states. But there are limits on that principle. One of those limits historically and traditionally has been states are not required to recognize marriages performed in other states. So, for example, different states have different age requirements for marriage. If one state allows marriage at, let's say, 15, a different state that doesn't allow marriage until the age of 18 historically has not been required to recognize as valid a marriage between 15-year-olds. And the theory is that the full faith and credit law clause gives way in situations where recognition of another state's actions would interfere with the basic public policy of the receiving state. The reason for that long-winded explanation is that this law purports to do something really very interesting that hasn't gotten much attention as far as I can see. It purports to make it a matter of federal law that all states must recognize marriages from all other states. And to me, the interesting question there is not on that section is not so much about religious freedom as it is about why does Congress have the authority to do this at all?
So this would be a state's rights issue, and the law or the bill that is written, the Respect for Marriage Act, would supersede those states' rights when it came to recognizing marriages?
Well, it's partly a state's rights issue. It's actually more immediately a separation of powers issue because it is the courts and the Supreme Court that in the past have said states don't have to recognize marriages under the Full Faith and Credit Clause. So this looks a lot like Congress trying to tell the courts how to interpret the Constitution. And that's something that the courts and the Supreme Court in particular have been very, very eager to prevent in the past, going back to the 1980s and 90s.
Howard Schwaber.
But there's also one other section
yes.
of the law. Oh, sorry.
No, that's what I was asking about, this fourth section here.
Right. So Section 4 says, and again, it's worded in an interesting way. It doesn't say that the federal government must recognize all interracial or all same-sex marriages. It says the federal government must recognize as valid marriages that are recognized as valid wherever they're performed. So if a state recognizes same-sex marriage, the federal government must recognize a same-sex marriage in that state as valid. If a state does not recognize same-sex marriage, the federal government has no obligation under this law to, for example, grant marital tax status to a couple claiming to be married in contravention of the law of the state that they're in. So you've got three pieces here. You've got two pieces that really matter. That full faith and credit section says that any state official who refuses to accept as valid and give effect to a marriage from another state can be sued by the people who are affected. And Section 4, that federal law section, says that for all purposes, and there are an enormous, more than 1,000 places in the federal law where being married or not being married matters for one reason or another. In all of those areas, all of those parts of the federal law, the federal government must follow whatever the state of origin of the marriage is.
Howard Schwaber, our guest, professor of political science and legal studies, along with affiliate faculty at the UW-Madison Law School. And while the repealing of the Defense of Marriage Act would be considered uncontroversial to you, Howard, because it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, isn't that decision from the Supreme Court the reason that we're revisiting these marriage equality rights today?
Well, that depends whom you ask. So this discussion goes back to the Dobbs case that overruled Roe versus Wade in June. And there was a great deal of discussion both in the opinions in that case and in commentary about that case. Does this mean the Supreme Court is poised to overrule Obergefell versus Hodges, which was the case that gave constitutional protection to same-sex marriage, or to overrule Windsor versus the United States, which was the case that said the federal government must recognize same-sex marriages if a state recognizes them? The justices have not said they have any intention of overruling those cases. A lot of people, myself included, suspect it's a distinct possibility. So, you know, the way this question was framed was about religious freedom. And I find that a very, very interesting way to frame the issue, because nothing in this law obviously affects religious freedom in any way. Nothing in the Respect for Marriage Act says anything about the way private individuals have to conduct their businesses. Churches have to conduct their services. It only affects the way state officials have to ask. And the reason that's so interesting is if you remember the case of Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who, in defiance of the order of the governor, refused to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple. In March of 2022, just this past March, a federal court ruled that she had violated their rights and couldn't do that. The only way I can really easily see any kind of religious freedom issue here is if the Republicans want to argue that state officials who have religious objections to their own state's laws shouldn't have to enforce them. But that would be a really radical position. So I really have to wonder whether the whole issue of religious liberty is just a smokescreen here, or whether perhaps people simply haven't read the law.
Howard Schwaber, our guest, and if you would like to join the conversation or if you have questions for our expert, please join us at 1-800-642-1234. But Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion that the court may want to rethink the Obergefell decision from 2015 in the decision that ended Roe v. Wade or changed Roe v. Wade. So how big of a concern is there that the court could reconsider this decision in other similar cases, Howard?
Well, we have to break it down a little bit because Thomas's opinion said a lot more than that. There are basically, this can get complicated, but there are basically two kinds of constitutionally guaranteed rights that apply against the states. One is a set of rights that comes from the Bill of Rights, from the text of the Bill of Rights, and is applied against the states through a doctrine called incorporation. So the Bill of Rights only applied against the federal government up until the 1920s, but in the 20th century, it's been held to apply, or some of it, or most of it, has been held to apply to the states. The other set of rights are called substantive due process rights. And all of the rights that aren't actually in the Bill of Rights that we're familiar with, including the right to privacy, for example, fall into that category, or the right of parents to control the education of their children, a whole slew of rights. Thomas's opinion called on the court to revisit and perhaps reject all of those rights.
Oh.
Not necessarily because he's hostile to the rights themselves, but because he thinks that way back in the 1870s, there was a major error of reasoning, and we should go back and start over. Thomas's position on this is consistent. He's made this argument for many years, and no one else on the court has ever bought it. So there's little chance, I think, of this court or following the Roberts Court, following Thomas all the way down that particular rabbit hole, wiping out more than 100 years of rights jurisprudence and starting over from scratch. On the other hand, not only Thomas's opinion, but also Alito and other justices wrote things that seemed to suggest that there's a distinction between the cases that came before Roe, finding things like a right to privacy for contraception, for example, and cases that came after Roe, like Obergefell. Certainly politically, we know it's a cause very near and dear to the hearts of judicial conservatives to overturn same-sex marriage as a right. So, I mean, that's second after abortion on the list of priorities. So on the one hand, it does not seem likely that the Roberts Court is going to wipe out, you know, rights that were recognized in the 1910s and 20s and, you know, 40s and 50s. On the other hand, it is hard to be confident that they will not revisit the same-sex marriage cases. And statements by Republican members of the Senate to the effect, for example, oh, well, this court would never revisit a decision that affects so many people's lives, you know, are kind of belied by the fact that in Dobbs they overruled Roe. And right now we have Lindsey Graham proposing a national anti-abortion law. So it's a very intensely political constitutional debate, and one in which I think people are quite right to at least be very concerned that the constitutional right to same-sex marriage recognition could very well be on the block in this next term or the one after.
1-800-642-1234 to join us with our guest, Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies, affiliate faculty at the law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What do you want to know about this legislation? What questions do you have about your rights and how they may be changing? Or others' rights? Are they yours too? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation with Howard Schwaber, legal studies and political science professor at UW-Madison. He's with us today looking at the Respect for Marriage Act and why some opponents have concerns about its passage. You can join us at any point, 1-800-642-1234. And what questions do you have about religious liberties, marriage equality, civil rights? Do you think we have enough legal protections for religious freedoms in this country? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org anytime. And Howard, this bill itself, and Senator Baldwin points this out, it's less than 500 words total. The bill is shorter than her op-ed piece that she published promoting it. Do you think the way it was written left too much up to interpretation? Does it need more clarification? Or as you mentioned, should some of these clauses be eliminated to make it more palatable?
Well, I think there's a real conflict here between the political optics and the actual content of the bill. In this instance, and frankly, quite often, short is good. Very often, it's the wordy bills and the long-winded explanations that raise ambiguities and complexities. This is very straightforward and very simple as a set of legal principles. And as I said, I think the most potentially controversial legal issue is one no one seems to be paying attention to, which is, can Congress dictate how the Constitution is interpreted by courts as a matter of separation of powers? But the political optics are all about the religious freedom issue. And again, I truly don't see how that's involved, since this law does not purport to regulate any private citizen's behavior. But certainly, and Senator Baldwin has said this, you know, it wouldn't hurt anything to add an amendment that says nothing in this law shall be construed to in any way change existing protections for religious freedom. And if that would satisfy some Republican members of the Senate, you know, I certainly don't see any harm in adding it.
And we've mentioned Senator Baldwin here, but what about Wisconsin's other U.S. Senator, Ron Johnson? Do we know where he stands on this issue and this bill, the Respect for Marriage Act?
We really don't, not because he hasn't said anything, but because he has said things that seem to contradict one another in a relatively short period. I think my read is that Senator Johnson is still trying to figure out what his position should be as a political matter, and so to speak, which way the winds are blowing. And he will ultimately decide whether to support or oppose the bill solely based on that calculation. I don't think any change to the content. I don't think he has any genuine concerns about the content. I think he's just trying to figure out what's the best way to position himself on an issue that is, after all, divisive among Republican Wisconsin voters, as well as, of course, Democratic Wisconsin voters.
Sure. And Howard Schwaber, as we look at the politics of this, now we know that the vote will be pushed past the midterms. Does that give perhaps the inclination that this bill will be passed, will get 10 Republican votes at some point, but not before we vote on them first?
It does. So it's an interesting maneuver. And again, this is only my opinion, obviously, but it seems to me that this decision increases the chance of the bill being passed, but decreases the significance of the debate for the midterms themselves. So a lot of Democrats would love to have this bill be one of the things that is front and center going into the midterms, because all sorts of polling data show that majorities of Americans, even majorities of Republicans, majorities of pretty much any category you can name, Protestants, Catholics, however you want to slice up the electorate, support same-sex marriage rights. So on the one hand, from the Democrats' perspective, you know, it might be useful to have this in everyone's face going into the midterms and say, see, if you vote for Republicans, you're voting against your own belief in the right to same-sex marriage. Conversely, if this is an issue in the midterms, that makes it much harder for Republican senators, remember this has been passed in the House, so we're talking about the Senate, to take a position that it might alienate their base. And of course, when you start talking about parties and bases and districts or states, excuse me, that are significantly blue or significantly red, you know, someone running for Senate has a lot less freedom of maneuver. So I think this is, on the one hand, a really good decision if the goal is to secure marriage equality in federal law. As a purely tactical partisan move, it weakens the Democratic position. But that's presumably one of the reasons Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, was willing to co-sponsor the bill, that it has been, by this move, I won't say removed from consideration in the midterms, but a much, much less central issue.
Yeah, who do you think Howard Schreiber benefits the most, and who would benefit the least from this bill? And is who stands to gain here?
Well, so the background, I mean, the point of all this is something I said earlier, which is that a lot of people think it is possible the Supreme Court will change its mind and remove the constitutional protection from same-sex marriage. And so in the first instance, this bill uses federal law to protect same-sex couples who want to get married and everything that goes with that, their children, right? All of the things that go along with that legal status. And so in that sense, you know, the benefit is very clear. It's protecting a vulnerable minority. Politically, I think it's much less clear. First of all, if this bill is passed, I think that will primarily have the effect of removing same-sex marriage as a partisan political issue, except in local elections, or in primaries. In other words, once you get a lot of primaries take place in very safe districts. As a result, they are won by candidates who take ideologically fairly extreme positions, trying to appeal to the base, as we say. But as a matter of national politics or state legislative politics, you know, the issue will be largely off the table. The problem is, as I say, I think that there's a serious constitutional defect in this bill. I think that if this came before the Supreme Court, if it were passed as a law, it might very well be struck down on separation of powers grounds, having nothing to do with the underlying issue. And that would throw everything into chaos. So I will be watching very, very curiously to see what is said about the full faith and credit clause element of the bill and whether that piece reaches a federal court sooner rather than later.
And again, Howard, you earlier said that this was because this bill appears to, the Respect for Marriage bill, appears to be telling the courts from Congress how to interpret the Constitution. And so would there be some unintended consequences that you could see as a result of this bill passing as it is?
Only that the court might reject it. So the Supreme Court, going back to the 1980s, has taken a very, very strong line that Congress does not get to tell courts how to interpret the Constitution. The court has been very jealous of that authority. So, you know, unintended, I mean, you can see why the provision is there. A federal law to be effective in this area, right, has to, all federal laws, if they're valid, supersede state laws. This one would have to declare that state laws are what is called preempted. So the federal law trumps, and states are required to recognize same-sex marriages and interracial marriages. Well, that one, of course, is not really an immediate issue, even for people who travel across state lines. That's certainly a good intention and unquestionably an element that is essential to make this law effective. The unintended consequence may be that Congress is simply overreaching. It is not clear, at least to me, what is the basis for federal authority to decide this question. And so all kinds of questions about separation of powers and federalism and the powers of Congress that people really aren't thinking about right now, because right now, of course, we're all thinking about the rights question and the equality question and the marriage question. But all those other structural issues really are very much at the heart of this thing. And I don't think that the authors of the bill have taken sufficient care. For example, there's nothing in the bill that explains the justification for the assertion of federal authority here, which is something you see quite a lot. in federal economic legislation, for example.
So maybe 500 words in this bill could be expanded a little more to protect the bill a little more against court challenges in the future?
It might be a worthwhile endeavor. I'm not sure it can be effective.
And finally, Howard, and we only have about a minute left here, but the argument we've heard against the Respect for Marriage Act has largely circled around religious liberties, which is something you haven't seen here. You've provided a more nuanced and certainly constitutional perspective on potential issues with this bill. But what about religious liberties here? Are they being infringed upon?
Since the law, the proposed federal law, doesn't dictate anything to any private party, it's hard for me to see how. No one who is not a state official is called upon to do anything under this law. So the only way there could be a religious liberty issue is if you say that someone who is a state official who has religious objections to something therefore doesn't have to carry out state law. That's the Kim Davis position. I should say that Kim Davis's lawyers have said they want to use her case to try and secure an overruling of Obergefell and Windsor, those cases I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So they understand perfectly well that they're swimming upstream, but they're hoping for a change in constitutional doctrine. But I have to say, it is very difficult for me to see how religious liberty is an issue here at all. I rather suspect that a lot of people raising that point haven't looked at the bill carefully.
Howard, yeah, and I apologize because we are plumb out of time here this afternoon, but always appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at the UW-Madison, also an affiliate faculty at the law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.